I've been asking the folks in New Mexico to pay attention to the teaching and reading I've been doing on the UFO crash sites that are so alleged near Roswell, New Mexico. I keep hoping, since we're in New Mexico, that I will hear from some of them there that I have personal or eyewitness experience with these events. Now, I've been reading the book UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. Major Jesse Marcel. The book has pictures of him with the so-called balloon wreckage that became the cover story for the crash. He's showing the remains of the weather balloon in General Ramey's office. The record here says he later told friends that the real wreckage had been removed and the balloon substituted. There's a picture of General Ramey in his office with the remains of the weather balloon. Photo courtesy of Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And a comment, there's no doubt that Ramey had the real debris switched, and what was photographed was a Rowan target device. In May 1990, the writers of this book had located Major Jesse Marcel near Missoula, Montana. They had a hypnotist with them. As they continued to pursue this story, having heard that Major Marcel had said to friends that it wasn't a weather balloon, in spite of, while in his army tenure, supporting the weather balloon story, with everything in place, Smith and Randall left for Montana. When they arrived in Missoula, they met with Watkins. You'll know more about him. He told them more about his background, including his work on the Hillside Strangler case of Los Angeles, fear and fame. If nothing else, Watkins was used to controversy. Watkins made it clear that he had spent years as a psychologist. He worked in VA hospitals treating soldiers for mental disorders stemming from their combat experiences. He is a psychology professor emeritus at the University of Montana. Turn me down just a little. I sound like I'm in a barrel in here. Watkins is the author of 6 books, over 90 papers, more than 100 articles on various aspects of his research and hypnosis. So from Missoula, they drove to Jesse. You want me to keep pursuing this as we have time? From Missoula, they drove to Jesse Marcel's home. While Watkins talked to Jesse Marcel, Smith and Randall interviewed his mother. They wanted to learn what her impressions were when Major Marcel brought home some of the material recovered on the crash site. She said that Jesse Sr. was excited about it. He thought that it was something extraordinary, and of course she didn't know what it could be. They had spread it out in the kitchen to examine it. Her descriptions of it matched those given by the others who had handled it. The afternoon sessions produced the best results with Jesse Marcel Jr. Neither Smith nor Randall expected anything spectacular. They hoped to learn in greater detail what had happened during the early morning examination of the debris by the Marcel family. Watkins worked with Marcel for nearly an hour, getting him to relax and finally into a light trance. Watkins had Marcel relive a few childhood memories, moving him from an early part of his life in Houston to Roswell, New Mexico. Slowly, Watkins brought Marcel, under hypnosis, forward until it was the end of the July 4th, 1947, weekend. Watkins, trying not to lead Marcel, suggested that something important was happening. That his father was there, excited about something. We're talking to Jesse Marcel, Jr. Watkins asked, "What is happening?" It was now as if Jesse Marcel, Jr. was being shaken from a sound sleep by his father in 1947. He was slightly confused because his father was standing over him trying to get him to wake up. Marcel followed his father outside to help carry in a box filled with debris. Jesse Jr. mentioned that his father had not driven a staff car out to the Brazel Ranch, but took their Buick convertible. Back inside the house, they spread the debris. Now, I skipped over the transition from Jesse Marcel, his position in the Army, their search. And if you're watching tonight for the first time, I've been reading from this book and others for several days, maybe even weeks now. Now they are examining the memory track under hypnosis of Jesse Jr. Back inside the house, as he relates it under hypnosis, they spread the debris over the kitchen floor, trying to fit the pieces together like a giant jigsaw puzzle, but the damage was too great. Nothing fit together. Smith leaned forward then and quietly asked, "How much of the floor was covered?" Marcel spoke slowly, quietly, as if examining it before he could answer the question. "It filled most of the kitchen floor, from the back door to the door that led into the living room. It was spread from the stove on the left across the floor to the sink and refrigerator." Marcel described some small, black, plastic-like material that was thicker than lead foil and that was much stronger. He said it looked like Bakelite. He also mentioned the lead foil and the I-beams. Watkins asked what was happening. Jesse Jr. said that his father was crouched near the back door trying to fit some of the pieces together, but they wouldn't fit. There was too much of it, and the damage had been too great. While Marcel and his son were trying to put together the debris, Marcel's wife picked up one of the I-beams and said, "There's writing on this." Jesse Jr. looked at one of the I-beams, noticed writing on it too. Under hypnosis, he said, "I can't read it." He hesitated and added, "Purple. Strange. Never saw anything like it." Randall asked him what the writing looked like. "Different geometric shapes, leaves, circles." Under hypnosis, Marcel drew the symbols as they appeared on the I-beam. Under questioning, Marcel said that the symbols were a shiny purple, that they were small, less than fingernail wide. There were many separate figures. He also described the beam. He said that it was broken at both ends, that it was made of the same material as the lead foil, and that it was cold to the touch. It was thicker and tougher than the lead. He could not bend it. While Marcel was still under hypnosis, Smith asked Jesse what his father was saying. "It's a flying saucer." "Is he using those words?" "Yes." I ask him what a flying saucer is. "I don't know what a flying saucer is." "What did he say?" "It's a ship. He's excited." Smith asked, "Does he say anything about a balloon?" "No. Only flying saucer." Marcel then described how he assisted his father putting the debris back in a large cardboard box. They carried it out and put it in the trunk of the Buick. Smith asked, "When is the next time you see him?" Answer, "The next day after work." "What day?" "Wednesday. I'm not in school. Don't keep track of the days." Marcel then said that his father didn't say anything about the flying saucer. In fact, Major Marcel cautioned his family about mentioning it at all. Major Marcel told them not to talk about it, to forget it. With Jesse Jr. still under hypnosis, Smith asked him when the next time his father mentioned the crash was. Jesse Jr. said that he was in high school and that his father still didn't know what it was. Marcel Sr. said, however, that it wasn't a balloon. It was not a radar target. Under more detailed questioning, Marcel remembered a few other details. His father told him that there had been a lot of debris on the ranch and that soldiers had been sent out to guard the field. The problem was that Jesse Jr. was only 11 years old. His father talked to his wife, but Jesse Jr. was more of an observer to those discussions and not a participant. In fact, when Smith and Randall tried to learn more about what Marcel said on the day of his return, Jesse Jr. told them that his parents were in the kitchen. He was waiting for his friend to come over. That was the end of the session. Both Smith and Randall agreed it had been valuable. If nothing else, they'd learned a few more details and gotten a drawing out of the symbols Marcel had seen on the I-beam. Smith conducted the final interview during the Montana trip. He visited with Robert Porter, hoping to learn a few new things about the first flight out of Roswell. According to Porter, the flight was authorized by Major Ralph R. Taylor. The material, the triangle-shaped package and the three or four shoeboxes, were brought to the aircraft by a staff car. Porter was sure that the material had been stored in Building 1034, which was labeled as an engineering building on the base map. Peter, go get that handheld. I want to show you some pictures. The point of this much reading is that too many witnesses, too many reports to be coincidence, something happened at Roswell that the government tried to cover up. That's very apparent. And then we come to July 1990, but before that, the pictures. Here's Major Jesse Marcel with the balloon wreckage. The cover story. Not the first story that had been released by Haupt. There's Major Marcel with another picture of the balloon. General Ramey in his office, whom this article says is the person who had the real debris switched and then had the weather balloon photographed for the cover story. General Ramey and his chief of staff inspecting the remains of the weather balloon. July 1990. Well, they show that. These are drawings by Glenn Dennis, formerly a mortician at Roswell in 1947. These illustrations are based on the actual drawings done in Mr. Dennis' presence by the nurse who participated in the preliminary autopsies at Roswell one day later. Five bodies claiming to have been found. Want me to continue? Get on telephone. We have joined additional people as we do every half hour, and I've been reading from The UFO Crash at Roswell, New Mexico by Kevin Randall and Donald R. Smith. They have been researching this for years. I have read at random through the book. The gestalt I hope to leap out of the book is that there are just too many witnesses, too many reports, too many cross-checkings, too much evidence of an attempt by the government to suppress the story and a government cover-up to conclude anything other than something very strange happened near Roswell, New Mexico. Not a weather balloon crash, some strange unidentified vehicle. There are multiplied claims of bodies at the site, quickly taken with the government. And a cover-up. Now, this is maybe in a little book, the most complete study of the Roswell situation. They followed lead after lead. Each person they would research and interview would suggest someone else. And they would chase all the leads down. And that's what we're still doing on television in New Mexico. I'm hoping there'll be people call me that know of some of these events, haven't had reason, in some cases courage, because of government pressure to speak out. I'd like to hear from you. If you don't want me to read your message or reveal your name, say so. I'll protect your confidentiality. But I have the hope that as we cover New Mexico and I raise this issue that's been a mystery since 1947, one of many such mysteries in the UFO scenario, I'll get some response out of New Mexico. At the same time, it's Monday night early in the week, and we are expecting our regulars to call until the 3,000 quota is made up. Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on Channel 2. There was an article in the Albuquerque Journal about 2 weeks ago. If you could find a copy and send it to me, anybody, I'd very much appreciate it. It gave a nutshell summary of the incident with photographs of a sketch of the alien. Also, I think it was on October 28th, there was a news article in Mountain Air Rainbow. The article stated that UFOs were buzzing residents in the area, that is, hovering approximately 100 feet overhead, nearby the Manzano Mountains. Last night, there was supposed to be another incident, a sighting of UFOs overhead in that area again. Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm checking in to tell you I'm watching. Channel 2. I know everything about this incident because I grew up around these people. The debris was found in Roswell, but the ship went down in St. Augustine, about 150 miles away. There were five bodies. You're right. It was not a weather balloon. After all of their research in this book, The UFO Crash at Roswell, Kevin Randall and Donald Smith, you may say, why are you reading this? Well, because I like to pursue truth, open minds. But maybe as much as anything, prove that a Christian spokesperson is not afraid of this. The Bible's full of UFOs. Our fundamentalists are going to have trouble figuring out how to explain UFOs. I don't have any trouble believing there's life on other planets. I believe heaven's out there somewhere. I want my congregation to have an open mind, not a closed mind. And they have cataloged the sequence of events from all of their research, chasing down every lead up to the date of this publication, as well as anyone, anywhere. Wednesday, July 2nd, 1947, a timeline for the whole Roswell incident. 9:50 p.m., Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot reported an oval-shaped object, like two inverted saucers facing mouth-to-mouth, moving at a high rate of speed. Flew over their house in Roswell, New Mexico. The object was heading to the northwest. This is the summary timeline of all the interviews, of which I only picked a little bit. During a thunderstorm in the Corona, New Mexico area, W.W. Mac Brazel heard a tremendous thunderclap that sounded like an explosion, but that was somehow different than the rest of the thunder. Others in the area reported the same phenomenon. William Woody reported that he and his father watched a bright meteor, described as white with a red tail streak across the sky, falling to the horizon. Thursday, July 3rd, 1947. Because of the rain the night before, Brazel inspected the pastures. July and August are the rainy months, and Brazel planned to move the livestock onto the fields that had received the rain. During the inspection, he discovered a large debris field. Scattered on the slopes and into the sinkholes and depressions was metal. Plastic-like beams, pieces of lightweight material, foil and string. The debris was thick enough that the sheep refused to cross the field and had to be driven around it to water more than a mile away. Brazel, taking a few scraps of the material, headed to the home of his closest neighbors, Floyd and Loretta Proctor. He showed them a little sliver of material that refused to burn and couldn't be cut. The Proctors suggested that he take it into town to show the sheriff. Loretta Proctor also remembered the rewards being offered for proof of the flying disc's reality and thought that Max should try to claim the money. Later that evening, Brazel removed the large circular piece of the debris from the range. According to Bill Brazel, his father either loaded it into the back of his truck or dragged it along behind. He stored it in a livestock shed about 3 miles north of the crash site. You can picture that, Peter, that livestock shed. There it is. Saturday, after storing it, July 5th, 1947. I had just graduated from high school. God, that's a long time ago. Military bases along the West Coast had fighters on standby in case the flying discs were seen. A few of the bases in Oregon and Washington had planes equipped with gun cameras on airborne alert because of a rash of UFO sighting reports. Sherman Campbell of Circleville, Ohio, reported to the sheriff that he thought he had an explanation for some of the flying disc sightings. He had found a weather balloon on his farm. It was metallic, with a kite-like appendage on it. Under the right conditions, as it drifted on the upper atmosphere winds, it could look like a flying disc. The device was on display at the local newspaper office and then returned to Campbell. Jean Campbell Romero, Campbell's daughter, reported that it had been kept in the barn for years afterward. Sunday, July 6, 1947. Brazel got up early, as was his habit, completed his chores, and then drove into Roswell about 75 miles away. He stopped at the office of Sheriff George A. Wilcox. Contrary to published reports, Wilcox was excited about the find and suggested they call the military. While they were waiting for the military officers to arrive, Wilcox dispatched two deputies to the ranch. They had only the directions given by Brazel, but both men were familiar with the territory, and Wilcox thought they'd be able to find the debris field that Brazel described. Frank Joyce, on that same day, Sunday, July 6, 1947, a reporter and announcer for radio station KGFL said that he called the sheriff and asked if there's anything interesting happening at the office. According to Joyce, Wilcox told him there was someone there he should interview. Joyce talked to Brazell, but said he didn't pay much attention to what Brazell was saying. He was busy trying to run the station, get the records changed, and listen to the story that Brazell was telling. Colonel William Blanchard, commander of the 509th Bomb Group, Major Jesse A. Marcel, the air intelligence officer, and a man in civilian clothes, a counterintelligence agent, responded to the sheriff's call. According to Phyllis McGuire, daughter of the sheriff, the military arrived almost as soon as the sheriff had hung up the phone. The officers interviewed Brazell, examined some pieces of the material, and then Blanchard ordered Marcel and the counterintelligence man to accompany Brazell to the ranch. Blanchard, sure that he was in possession of something unusual, alerted the next higher headquarters. According to Blanchard's first wife, Ethel, this is the timeline, the results of all their interviews. He thought that they might have found something that belonged to the Soviets. No one mentioned any type of balloon. Blanchard, acting on orders from General Clements McMullen, passed to him by Colonel Thomas DuBose, sealed in a bag, some of the material Brazell had brought to the sheriff's office. The material was then flown on to the Fort Worth Army Airfield. After the military officers left, along with Brazell, the two deputies, sheriff's deputies, returned. They hadn't found the debris field, but they did find a burned area in one of the pastures. The sand had been turned to glass and blackened. Remember, I told you once how the dangling wires of an antenna of a powerful shortwave station makes what they call glass eggs, as the dust turns to glass. It looked as if something circular had touched down. Weather balloons don't have that capacity. The aircraft from Roswell was met at the Fort Worth Army Air Force Base, or airfield, by DuBose and Colonel Alan D. Clark. Clark received the plastic bag with the debris and walked to the command B-26 to fly it on to Washington, D.C., and General McMullen. Because it was so far out to the ranch over roads that were less than adequate, Brazell, Marcel, and the CIC agent didn't arrive until after dark. They stayed at the ranch house, ate cold beans and crackers, and waited for daylight. Marcel used a Geiger counter on the large piece of wreckage that Brazell had stored in the cattle shed. He detected no sign of radiation. Monday. July 7th. Brazell took the two military officers out to the crash site. According to Marcel, the debris field was 3/4 of a mile long, 200 to 300 feet wide. There was a gouge starting at the northern end of it that extended for 400 or 500 feet toward the other end. Bill Brazell said that it looked as if something had touched down and skipped along. The largest piece of debris was found at the southern edge of the gouge. Marcel described the debris as being as thin as newsprint, but so strong he couldn't bend it. There was foil that, when crumbled, would unfold itself without a sign of a wrinkle. There were I-beams that would flex slightly and that had some sort of writing or symbols on them. The description of the debris was confirmed by Bill Brazell, Loretta Proctor, Tommy Tyree, Walt Whitmore, Sr., Jesse Marcel, Jr., Miss Viaud Marcel, Robert Shirky, Robert Smith, O.W. Henderson, and Louis S. Rickett. Again, this timeline, the result of a book full of interviews. Am I boring you? Marcel and the CIA agent walked the perimeter of the field, then ranged out looking for more debris or another crash site, but found nothing. Finally, they returned and spent the remainder of the day collecting the debris they could. They loaded the rear of Marcel's 42 Buick and then the Jeep carryall driven with a CIC man. About dusk, they left the field for Roswell. Lieutenant General Nathan F. Twining, the commander of the Air Material Command, the parent organization at Wright Field, Ohio, changed his plans suddenly on that Monday and flew into the Alamogordo Army Airfield, later Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico. Twining was just a short drive from the Roswell Army Airfield. Tuesday, July 8th, 1947, 2 a.m. Marcel, excited by the find, stopped at his house on the way to the base. He awakened his wife and son to show them the material. They spent an hour examining it, scattered it on the kitchen floor. Marcel was not breaking regulations since nothing he brought in had yet been classified. Marcel then collected it all, loaded it into the car, and drove to the base. 6 a.m. Marcel, the counterintelligence agent, visited with Blanchard in his quarters, telling him what they had seen. In later years, Marcel would insist that they knew the moment they saw the debris field that the crash was of something that had not been manufactured on Earth. Blanchard called the provost marshal, identified in the 509th unit history as Major Edwin Easley. Blanchard ordered Easley to post guards on the roads around the crash site, denying access to anyone without official business. He ordered Easley to find Brazell and have him escort the MPs to the crash site. Blanchard also called 8th Air Force Headquarters and advised them that Marcel had returned with more of the debris. By this time, Blanchard and Marcel knew that it was not a Russian device. 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth relayed Blanchard's message up the chain of command, alerting the Pentagon about the strange material. A special flight from Andrews was arranged for men coming from the Pentagon. 7:30 a.m. The regular morning staff meeting had been moved up. Blanchard discussed what they had found and what they should do about it. Attending that meeting were Marcel, the counterintelligence man, Lewis S. Rickett, Lieutenant Colonel James I. Hopkins, the operations officer, Major Patrick Saunders, the base adjutant, Major Isidore Brown, the personnel officer, and Lieutenant Colonel Ulysses S. Nero, the supply officer. There is no reason to believe the Colonel or Lieutenant Colonel Charles W. Horton, Lieutenant Colonel Fernand L. Andry, and Lieutenant Walter Hout, the public information officer, were also in attendance. During the meeting, they decided how to handle the retrieval and who would be accomplishing which tasks. 9 a.m. The counterintelligence agent and his assistant drew a staff car and drove to the crash site. Following them was another contingent of MPs. They were stopped by the guards that had been posted earlier. When they arrived, they saw that MPs had already been stationed around the debris field to protect it. Blanchard and members of his staff were on the phones, conferring with higher headquarters. Marcel and some of the wreckage were ordered to Fort Worth so that Brigadier General Roger Ramey could inspect it. 11 a.m. Walter Hout finished the press release and was preparing to take it into town. The first paragraph said, quote, "The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday." He took it first to one of the radio stations. By noon, he had given a copy of the release to both radio stations and to both daily newspapers. The counterintelligence men at the ranch checked the ground again. The guards were posted around the gouge, around the debris field, and finally on the hills surrounding the area. The counterintelligence men located Mac Brazel and took him back to Roswell. PM. Every point of contact in Roswell reported that they were swamped by calls. Sheriff Wilcox reported calls from Europe and Asia. Art McQuitty, editor of the Roswell Morning Dispatch, said that from the moment the press release hit the wire, he was on the phone. Walter Hout said the same thing. The world was trying to learn what happened in Roswell. The first of the special flights from Washington arrived. On the plane was Warrant Officer Robert Thomas. Thomas and the men were in uniform upon arrival, but quickly changed to civilian clothes. These men would remain at Roswell throughout the retrieval. The phones at the base had started to ring. Blanchard, irritated because he couldn't get a phone line, ordered Hout to do something about all the incoming calls. Hout said there was nothing they could do about the incoming calls. Sheriff Wilcox, wondering what happened out at the crash site, sent two more deputies out. This time they ran into the cordon thrown up by the Army and were turned back. The Army was letting no unauthorized personnel onto the crash site. Mid-afternoon, Brazel was flown back toward the ranch. His was not the first flight back at the 500, back as the 509th tried to find the flight crew of the craft. They were all sure that there had to be one. The second crash site was located, and men on the ground were directed toward it. Brazel, because he knew the land well, was helping to direct them in toward the second site. Before the Army could arrive, if you want me to continue, you get on the telephone. I'm sure most of you figured out that those were the buses in an earlier film sequence in the previous song. Those were pictures of the buses arriving at the Cathedral Sunday, Anniversary Sunday, and the first look of many of those who got off the bus, of that towering crane with that part of one of the Jesus Save signs that we expect to be installed by next Sunday, hanging up in the sky above the cathedral on the back side. They were entering the parking lot in the back. I'm sure you could witness their joy. It's been a long, hard fight. We did not move downtown to make a financial investment. All the other Protestant churches fled the downtown, as the LA Times said, because of mounting expenses and dwindling congregation. We went downtown expecting to spend to make sure that the testimony of faith in God that's been a part of the City of the Angels for so many years was preserved by someone. And these Jesus Save signs are historic monuments in the city of Los Angeles, now wed to the historic monument, our cathedral. And it is a great time of rejoicing, and you can see it on the faces of the people. I'm sure they'll run some of it again tonight, but right now I'm reading on the UFO incident in Roswell, New Mexico, but not unless you keep calling and checking in. I still have to find 3,000 each week who call and say, I've been taught, and because of the teaching, I want to be one of the 3,000 that you can count on this week. Somebody asked, are the Jesus Save signs going to be lit at night? The answer is yes. They've been a presence in Los Angeles for many years, and now restored, going up on the top of the cathedral. And if you look closely last Sunday, even that partial sign that we had hanging in the air was lighted. So yes, they will be lighted. Cape. Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Or Girardeau, whichever it is. I'm picking you up on 1610 a.m. on my car radio. I'm almost 100 to 150 miles south of St. Louis. And I'm picking up the signal loud and clear. I'm driving north from Memphis and have been listening all night long. This is great. That's 1610 a.m. Back to UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Stephen Smith. And after a book full of interviews and tracing this mystery, they've constructed a timeline. A second crash site was located shortly after noon on Tuesday, July 8, 1947, the first find occurring, the first sight on the 4th of July weekend. The second crash site was located and men on the ground were directed toward it. Brazel, because he knew the land well, was helping to direct them in toward the second site. Before the army could arrive, others in the area stumbled onto the second site. Grady L. Barney Barnett was surveying the ranches for the suitability of irrigation. According to Vern Maltese, a close friend, Barnett found the remains of the disc. Maltese never asked about the craft because Barnett told him about the occupants. Small men. Four or five feet tall. It is kind of funny that the way they say it. I don't think I would ask about the craft either if you tell me about the man. Maltese never asked about the craft because Barnett told him about the occupants. Small men, 4 or 5 feet tall, thin, with big heads. They were lying outside the craft. While Barnett was standing there, close enough to touch the bodies, a group of students and archaeologists arrived. They too saw the bodies and the strange craft. I skipped over it, but they interviewed the archaeologists. Army arrived at the second crash and was horrified to find civilians there already. The civilians were rounded up and told that they had stumbled upon something that had national security aspects. They were never to mention what they had seen. The officer in charge told them that the government would be able to find them if they talked. You remember I read to you a few weeks back the law in the federal code that most people never heard of, giving absolute unilateral and total authority to quarantine indefinite those exposed to extraterrestrial matter. The officer in charge told them that the government would be able to find them if they talked. They were escorted off the site as the army moved in and began to cover the bodies. Robert Shirkey, standing in the operations building, watched as MPs began carrying wreckage through to load onto a C-54 of the 1st Air Transport Unit. To see better, Robert Shirkey had to step around Colonel Blanchard. Pappy Henderson, Captain O.W. Henderson, then took the material to Wright Field in Ohio. He had a chance to see some of the material and described it as something very strange and like nothing he had ever seen. 2:30 p.m. Blanchard decided that it was time to go on leave. There were too many phone calls into the base asking to speak to him. He, along with a few members of the staff, drove out to the crash site. Those left at the base were told to inform the reporters that the colonel was now on leave. 3 p.m. Marcel, who had been told that he was going to Fort Worth with the wreckage, took off for the Fort Worth Army Airfield. According to Sergeant Robert Porter, one of the flight crew, there were only a few packages loaded onto the plane. One, a triangular package about 2 feet long, was wrapped in brown paper. The other three were about shoebox-sized and also wrapped. Porter said that it seemed that there was nothing in them. Johnny McBoyle, a reporter for radio station KSWS in Roswell, tried to reach the crash site. According to Merle Tucker and Lydia Sleppy, who worked at the parent station in Albuquerque, McBoyle mentioned an object that looked like a crushed dishpan and then told her to hang on. There was an argument with someone close, and then McBoyle told her to never mind. He'd made a mistake. Moments later, as she was trying to get something out over the teletype, it, that is the teletype, began to type out an incoming message from the FBI. She was ordered not to complete the transmission because the item is of national security interest. Marcel was in Ramey's office with some of the debris. The general wanted to see where it had been found, and Marcel was taken to a map room. Once Ramey was satisfied, they walked back to the office, but the debris was gone. In its place was a weather balloon that had been ripped apart. Late afternoon, Brazil was back in Roswell, having helped find the second crash site. Now the military dropped the ball. No one told him to stay close, so Brazil left. Walt Whitmore found him in Roswell and took him to the radio station KGFL. Whitmore and another reporter interviewed Brazil using the wire recorder. Remember those? Most of you are not old enough. On it, Brazil told them the whole story. Whitmore then took Brazil to his house to keep him out of the hands of the military. In Fort Worth, reporter J. Bond Johnson of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram was told to drive to the base. His editor said that they had a flying saucer coming in from Roswell, and he wanted Johnson out there to cover the story. Johnson arrived at the Fort Worth Air Base and was told to head straight up to Ramey's office for the interview. On the floor were the remains of a weather balloon. Part of the rubber in it had burned, and Johnson was surprised that Ramey would keep it in his office. Johnson took 4 pictures of Ramey and the wreckage and then headed back to his office. We showed you some of those pictures in the previous half hour. More people arrived at the crash site, and they were cleaning it up. Men with wheelbarrows were moving across the field. This was a busy day. Men with wheelbarrows were moving across the field, throwing the debris in. When filled, they took the debris to collection points. The debris was then loaded into covered trucks to be driven into Roswell. Warrant Officer Irving Newton was ordered from the weather station to Ramey's office. Newton, in front of a small number of reporters and officers of the 8th Air Force, identified the wreckage on the office floor as a Rowan target balloon. He was photographed and then sent back to his regular duties. Ramey, with the identity of the records thus established, announced to the world that the officers at Roswell were fooled by a weather balloon. Ramey also appeared on local radio station WBAP. And the government wants to check on the morality of churches. Blanchard and members of his staff arrived at the ranch and were taken to the second crash site where the bodies were located. The bodies were loaded into the back of a truck and then covered by a tarp. In Roswell, the base hospital began to call a local mortuary, asking questions about the preservation of tissue and what specific chemicals would do to the tissue. The mortician, Glenn Dennis, reported he received four or five such phone calls about it and decided there had been a fatal crash at the base. Lewis S. Rickert said an unscheduled flight from Bowling Field, Washington, D.C. arrived. He gave the crew a sealed box with wreckage in it. Melvin E. Brown, a member of Squadron K, 509th Bomb Group, was told to climb into the back of a truck at the second crash site. He was told not to look under the tarp, but the moment everyone's back was turned, he did. Under the tarp were the bodies of the alien flight crew. Brown said that they were small, with large heads, and that he thought the skin was yellow or orange. The bodies arrived at the base and were taken to the hospital for examination. Dr. Jesse Johnson pronounced them dead and did the preliminary work on them. The mortician, Glenn Dennis, still believing there had been a fatal crash on the base, drove out. The MP on the gate, recognizing him, waved him through and he drove to the hospital. There he entered and was met by an Army nurse. She told him to get out before he got himself into trouble. Two MPs spotted him and bodily threw him out of the hospital. A guard at the gate reported that a truck carrying dry ice entered late in the evening. He was surprised by the late hour of the delivery. A check of the local ice house revealed no records available for the 1940s. Yeah. The bodies were sealed into a long crate, 15 feet by 3 feet by 4 feet, and the crate was moved to a hangar. It was left there, with the dry ice, I guess. With spotlights playing on it while MPs stood guard, they never approached it. Brown was given the task of guarding the outside of the hangar. Brown's commanding officer approached and said, "Come on, Brownie, let's have a look inside." But there was nothing to see then, because everything had been packed and crated and was ready for shipment out of there. Wednesday, July 9th, 1947. Morning newspapers were carrying the story that the flying saucer found in Roswell was a weather device. Some quoted Ramey, while others quoted sources, including senators in Washington. Brazel was still in Roswell, but still in the company of Walt Whitmore. Whitmore was trying to protect his exclusive interview with Brazel. Cleanup at the ranch resumed with sunup. The military was trying to get everything packed up before any more civilians stumbled across it. Robert Smith of the 1st Air Transport Unit said that they began loading crates into C-54s about 8 o'clock in the morning. The problem wasn't the weight, but the size of the crates. They felt as if they were empty. They loaded three aircraft, all destined to Kirtland and then on to Los Alamos. According to Roswell Army Airfield Head Secretary Elizabeth Kyle, the telephones at the base were still tied up by the incoming calls from around the world. The military found Brazell again and this time took steps to ensure that he didn't get away from them. They interrogated him at the base, asking him the same questions over and over again. More of the wreckage was brought into the base and was now being taken to a different location where it was boxed into crates of various sizes and shapes. The crates were built at Roswell and conformed to the standards used to ship other cargo. Bud Payne, a rancher in the Corona area, was chasing a stray cow. As he crossed onto the Foster Ranch, a jeep carrying soldiers roared over a ridge line bearing down on him. He was carried from the Foster Ranch. Brazell was taken into town. You want me to continue? Reading from the book UFO Crash at Roswell. Kevin D. Randall, Donald R. Smith. I understand one of the newspapers in New Mexico reviewed this book a few weeks ago. It usually happens when we go into an area. The bookstores sell out, and the newspaper people who will not admit they watch or listen will start writing reviews. I'm in that section of the book after their long anecdotal records of the research and the interviews up to and including the early 1990s. They have constructed a timeline based upon the interviews. We have proceeded along that timeline until Wednesday, July 9, 1947. Second crash site has been found. The first crash site was found on the 4th of July weekend. Bodies reported at this second crash site. Were Wednesday, July 9, 1947. Brazell, the farmer who found the first site, guided him to find the second, was taken into town into the officers of the Roswell Daily Record. There he gave reporters, including Jason Callahan and R.A. Adair from Albuquerque, a new story. He told them that he had found the balloon on June 14th and hadn't taken it into Roswell until 3 weeks later because he had no phone, no radio, and didn't know the world was looking for flying discs. Brazell, in that article, however, said that he had found weather balloons on other occasions, and what he had found this time was no weather balloon. Ramey's weather officer, Newton, claimed that the weather balloon was a special kind and said, "We use them because they go much higher than the eye can see." Floyd Proctor and Lyman Strickland were in Roswell and saw Mac Brazell. He was being escorted around by three military men. He ignored both Proctor and Strickland, something that he wouldn't normally have done. Whitmore at radio station KGFL got a phone call from Washington telling him not to air the interview with Brazell. According to Judd Roberts, if we played the interview, we could expect to lose our FCC license the next day. According to Art McQuitty, an officer from the base swept through Roswell picking up copies of Hout's press release. Frank Joyce confirmed it, saying that someone had searched the offices of KGFL. The military searched all the radio stations and the newspapers, taking anything that related to the story. At noon, the crate that had been sitting in the empty hangar guarded by the MPs was moved out to the bomb pit number one. According to the men who were there, nothing other than weapons was ever stored in the bomb pit. Late in the afternoon, a flight crew at the Skeet Range was told they had a special flight coming in. The Squadron Operations Officer Major Edgar Skelly told the aircraft commander to keep everyone together. Three C-54s from the 1st Air Transport Unit took off on short flights to Los Alamos. All three aircraft were loaded with crates holding the wreckage, and all the crates were marked with stencils saying, "Top Secret." It was a weather balloon, and they're showing it in the office of General Matt Ramey. Why the secrecy? Armed guards watched the loading of the aircraft. Smith was sure the crates held debris because he was shown a small piece of foil that could be wadded and then would straighten itself out. The flight crew pulled from the Skeet Range was told to quickly pre-flight their aircraft. Once that was done, and they had the engines running, they taxied out to the bomb pit. According to one of the crewmen on that flight, the only places on the base where the bomb pit could be observed were the tower and portions of the flight line. A sealed, wooden, unmarked crate was brought out and loaded into the bomb bay of B-29 tail number 7301. It was guarded by six MPs, an officer, two NCOs, and three enlisted men, all armed. They never let the crate out of their sight. At Fort Worth, the aircraft was met by a number of officers, including a mortician. Am I boring you? The bombardier recognized the man because he had gone to school with him. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been known he was a mortician. The crate was unloaded, and the flight crew was told to head back to Roswell. There was no debriefing given to them at Fort Worth. According to one of the crewmen and confirmed by Robert Slusher, Marcel returned with them on that flight. He was in Fort Worth for about 24 hours, and that had kept him out of the reporter's line of fire until the cover story could be put in place. Frank Joyce reported that officers brought Mac Brazell to radio station KGFL to be interviewed. This time, Brazell had a new story, one that was significantly different than the one he had told on Sunday. Joyce pointed that out, and Brazell responded that it would be hard or go hard on him if he didn't tell the new story. By 8 p.m., the flight crew was back. Again, they were not debriefed, but were told that they had flown the general's furniture to Fort Worth. Of course, you know, it's normal to load furniture and crates and store it in a bomb pit. I don't know what kind of furniture that was. They were cautioned not to tell anyone what they had done, including their families. The flight had not taken place. Upon his return, Marcel headed to the counterintelligence office and confronted the officer there. Marcel wanted to see the reports that had been filed in his absence, but the CIC officer refused. Marcel pointed out that he was the senior officer, but the CIC agent claimed his orders were from Washington and said, "Take it up with them." John Tiffany Sr. a crew chief assigned to Wright Field flew on a special mission to the south. They picked up debris that none of them could identify and a huge thermos-like jug. Tiffany told family members about the bodies, his descriptions matching those of the other witnesses. The Las Vegas Review-Journal carried a story quoting a UP report that said, quote, "Reports of flying saucers whizzing through the sky fell off sharply today as the Army and Navy began a concentrated campaign to stop the rumors." The story also said that AAF headquarters in Washington received a blistering rebuke, or rather delivered a blistering rebuke to officers at Roswell. The same article was printed in other newspapers around the country. Thursday, July 10th, 1947. Bill Brazell, reading the morning paper, learned about his father's activities at Roswell. He realized that no one would be at the ranch and made plans to get down there to help. At both crash sites, the men were working to get everything cleaned up. They wanted no bit of wreckage left and no signs that there were any there. Mac Brazell was being held in the guest house on the base. The officers there were still trying to convince him that he was not to say anything about what he had seen. They were also trying to keep him out of the way of reporters still searching for a story. He was given a physical by doctors at the base hospital. There were rumors flying around Roswell about the event. People began to hear that there were bodies, and there was even talk that one of them was alive when the military got there. Major W.D. Pritchard from Alamogordo claimed that there had been a unit from his base in Roswell launching balloons around June 14th. That was undoubtedly what Brazell found. There's a caller from Roswell, Channel 2. "My mother worked at the newspaper at the time, and according to what I was told and grew up hearing about, that what Mr. Brazell found when he found the aliens was that three of the aliens were already dead, one was dying, and one was still alive at the time. I grew up with this stuff. That's all we ever talked about while I was growing up." It gives me her name. Friday, July 11th, 1947. The debriefing of all the participants was underway. According to Frank Kaufman, they were taken into a room in small groups and told that the recovery was a highly classified event. No one was to talk about it to anyone. They were to forget that it ever had happened. Saturday, July 12th. 1947. Bill Brazell, son of Mac Brazell, and his wife Shirley arrived at the ranch, but there was no one around. Brazell began to work, first surveying the ranch to see what needed to be done. He saw no evidence that the military was still around. The trucks, people, and the cordon were gone. On this weekend, there were no aircraft with gun cameras searching for flying discs. There were no aircraft on standby waiting for orders to take off. In fact, there were reports that an order went out grounding all aircraft to keep them out of the sky and the search. Tuesday, July 15, 1947. Bill Brazell reported that his dad returned from Roswell. He would not say much, except that they kept asking him the same questions over and over again, and to say that Bill Brazell was better off not knowing what had happened. Besides, Mac Brazell took an oath that said he would never reveal in detail what he had seen. But now most of the world had forgotten that a flying saucer had been reported to have crashed in New Mexico. Late July 1947. Mac Brazell visited the Lyman Stricklands and told them what had gone on in Roswell. Marion Strickland said that Mac was upset over being in jail and the shabby way he'd been treated by the military. He sat in the kitchen at the table drinking coffee as he complained about the military. He would say nothing about what he had found other than he had been sworn to secrecy. August 1947. Mac Brazell, and ranch hand Tommy Tyree spotted a piece of wreckage floating in the water at the bottom of a sinkhole. Neither man bothered to climb down to retrieve it. September 1947. Lewis S. Rickett was assigned to assist Dr. Lincoln LaPaz from the University of New Mexico. LaPaz's three-week assignment was to determine, if possible, the speed and trajectory of the craft when it hit. According to Rickett, they discovered a touchdown point 5 miles from the debris field where the sand was crystallized, apparently from the heat, and they discovered more of the foil-like material. Given all that, LaPaz, not knowing that bodies had been recovered, was convinced that it had been an unoccupied probe from another planet. September 1948, 1 year later. The same Lewis S. Rickett, while in Albuquerque, met with the same Dr. Lincoln LaPaz. According to Rickett, LaPaz told him that he, LaPaz, was still convinced that what they had found was an unoccupied probe from another planet. In the year that had passed, LaPaz, in his secret dealings with various government projects, had found nothing to cause him to change his mind. October 1948, same year. The same Lewis S. Rickett met with John Wirth, another counterintelligence man. Rickett asked Wirth about the status of the material recovered at Roswell and was told that they had yet to figure it out. According to Wirth, they hadn't been able to cut it. Summer 1949, almost a year later. Bill Brazell, son of Mac Brazell, the original finder, in the 2 years following the crash, found scraps of the craft. His dad confirmed it, saying, "That looks like some of the contraption I found." Brazell and Corona mentioned that he had found some of the pieces. According to him, the next day, Captain Armstrong and three others from the Roswell base arrived and asked for the material. Armstrong reminded Brazell that his dad had cooperated with them. It was Brazell's patriotic duty to give it up. Brazell couldn't think of a good reason to deny it to them and surrendered it. UPI stringer Jay West reported that he was working in Alamogordo in the area of the White Sands Proving Ground when he became friendly with the base public information officer. The PIO, or public information officer, had found a file that mentioned the Roswell crash that included a map. The PIO got a topographical map of the crash site. According to West, they made trips out to try to locate the crash. West described the map as showing the debris field and then 2.5 miles to the east, a second crash site. 1978. 17 years later, Pappy Henderson, one of the pilots, confided in his close friend, John Cromshoulder, that he flew wreckage from a crashed saucer from Roswell, New Mexico, to Dayton, Ohio. He showed Cromshoulder a fragment of the debris and told his friend that he had seen the bodies. Jesse Marcel was located by researcher Stan Friedman. Marcel told Friedman that he was sure that the debris was nothing from Earth. Later, Marcel granted interviews to various news organizations, but those reports did not gain wide dissemination. Bob Pratt, May 1979. Bob Pratt interviewed Jesse Marcel and published an article in which Marcel admitted that he was the intelligence officer who had recovered the parts of a flying saucer. 1980. In Search Of aired a program about UFO cover-ups and interviewed Marcel. In the course of that interview, Marcel again said that whatever was found, he was sure that it was nothing from Earth, in spite of the earlier pictures with weather balloons. Want me to continue? Well, that depends on the number of calls I get as the music plays. There's a lot more here.